時々思う気持ちが
Hi everyone, I'm Kitsune. Apologies, I'm a little under the weather. My conversation today with 0x FBI Femboy goes some really interesting and nuanced places, everywhere from his story entering the space to the future of capitalism and our decentralized financial future, to the importance of watching sensitive sports anime from time to time. If you can, please leave us a review, a rating, our podcast on either Apple Music or Spotify. And please subscribe, as I'll be bringing you more stories each week from members of our crypto community. And now, enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, the first question I generally ask, my kind of jumping off point question is always like, how did you get here? How did you get into cryptocurrency? How did you get involved with the crypto space?
That's a good question. Well, it's actually an interesting story. I was chatting with a friend of mine, and I was asking them if I should buy some crypto, because I didn't have any crypto. This was about half a year ago at this point. I had never used Coinbase or an exchange or MetaMask or anything. I just thought, oh, you like bought some coins somewhere and maybe you could use a wallet or something, but I didn't really have any sense of what to do. And they were like, well, you know, you can observe the following, that cryptocurrencies are not perfectly correlated with the stock market, and cryptocurrencies are also exhibiting a rate of return that's substantially greater than the risk-free rate of return. So you probably, you know, according to more modern portfolio theory, you should therefore have at least a non-zero amount of cryptocurrency in your portfolio. And so I thought, well, I think that's compelling. That's fairly sensible. And so I registered for an exchange and I gave things a try. And I also started looking around a little bit more at what was going on in crypto, you know, what projects or services were being developed, and I thought it was very fascinating, the diversity of different platforms. You know, obviously there's a lot of just meme coins, and most of retail only will only see things like Dogecoin or Shiba coin. But if you just look a little bit more deeper, there's a very wide range of services and products being offered, like prediction markets, for example, betting platforms, decentralized finance, so lending, of course, lending and even now gaming, although I'm a bit skeptical of those applications, but at the very least people are trying, and it's a very stimulating era of innovation, right? Even if many things don't make sense, there's a sense in which people are at the very least giving any half reasonable idea, a good old try. I think that's a really good creative environment to be in. It's a very strong signal, I believe, that there's a lot of real innovation happening in the field.
There's a lot of like great things to dive into there, and I pretty much agree across the board. But you know, first I kind of want to call out, you know, it's a pretty incredible trajectory to like get into crypto half a year ago, and then like you're interviewing Tuba. Like, do you feel like kind of your, you know, like rapid immersion in crypto was deliberate? Like, did you just like kind of fall in love right off the bat and be like, I want to dedicate a lot of time and effort to like being a part of this world?
Yeah, I felt it was really quite immediate, the appeal, right? And there are really two parts to that. The first part is just the atmosphere is very enticing. Like, again, there's obviously a lot of crypto, which is very, very silly and not very good. But, you know, I think, at least on Twitter, for example, I've created a small sphere of friends and acquaintances that I find very fun to chat with, and you know, with whom I have a great deal of enjoyment spending time with virtually. And so from that perspective, both from a personal and intellectual viewpoint, it's very edifying. And then beyond that, there's obviously a financial incentive. I mean, I think most of us are here, at least I think so, to make some amount of money. And it's just the amount of liquidity in the space was staggering, right? I immediately, as soon as I started doing things on chain, I just immediately realized that whenever crypto is in a bull run, just the sheer amounts of money which is available, right? Like the pure inefficiency of the markets and the degree of speculation was just so extreme. You know, I could almost not believe my eyes. But I mean, 6 months ago, that was when things were just, actually, it wasn't even 6 months ago. It was 6 months ago. That was when things were starting to really ramp up, right, into the bull run in the late half of the year. So I was just astounded. People were paying this much money just to buy, a JPEG that I clicked mint on, and I could immediately make what is essentially a risk-free profit off this. I mean, it felt unbelievable, but there you go.
It definitely is unbelievable. I think it's interesting that you said two things that I wonder if they're not like oppositional, but maybe sympathetic in a way that people don't think about. Because you said, first, like, it is like such a creative space, and it is iterating in the style of a creative space. But we also have this, like you said, like heavy financial incentivization. Do you think that there is like the crypto has that like balance of creativity and then like the motivation for like financial profit or financial success? Like, is this the balancing act between like the creative and the financial?
I think there is certainly a balancing act. And it's easy for people to get caught up in the illusion that they're making a difference, even if they are not. I mean, it's hard to know what people's intentions are, of course, but we've seen a lot of projects fail over the last year, and overall the community, both the creators as well as people who invest in them or people who observe them, there is certainly a tendency to confuse financial success with real lasting significance, right? Because everything goes well for a while, you play the emissions game for a while, everyone is in profit for a little bit, and then eventually, of course, once liquidity runs out, people stop being in profit. There's no more excess liquidity, things dry up quickly and prices fall. But people were quick to confuse, those two aspects. Nevertheless, I think that's unavoidable, because part of the appeal of crypto, perhaps, is just that, or part of the innovation is intrinsically tied to financialization. So to some degree, this sort of free-form experimentation is exactly what's required for rapid growth. I mean, you could draw a parallel to machine learning and AI, where I think it was about 5-10 years ago, where you could raise tremendous, quite large amounts of money, right? Just putting AI or ML in your deck, and you didn't really need to have any idea what you were doing. And in reality, your AI or ML, didn't have to exist, first of all, or maybe it was just linear regression, or maybe it was just, some people in Colombia doing the data classification or whatever at the end of the day. But still, there was a lot of stupid money being thrown around for stupid products. But still, we see today that the effects of machine learning are very real. Google Translate is tremendously effective, and that relies on neural network development. Autonomous driving, it's still a ways off, but certainly advanced considerably in no small part due to the developments in machine learning. It's difficult to even imagine. Like, I imagine ML has affected the internet in so many different ways. It improves our usage of platforms like Twitter in ways that we can't even easily begin to fathom in terms of discovery and exploration of new content. So I think, to some extent, that sort of froth and that sort of investment of money in a tale of what are ultimately pretty stupid projects is perhaps not easily extricable, if you really want to get that upside in the long run.
There's the saying, right, like bear markets are for building. And so I think, there's a point to that when if liquidity is drying up, if profits are drying up, people tend to reallocate their efforts in a down market or when they're not being profitable to trying to build things, of course, to set themselves up for success the next time we have this financial incentivization, mm-hmm. the next time we have this retail liquidity. Like, is that, that's like an inverse relationship, right? Like, do you find that yourself, like right now in this period of our, I'm not going to say bear market because I don't want to, you know, jinx it, but in this period of downturn, have you found yourself to be like more involved in creative pursuits rather than just simple financial pursuits?
Yes, and I was really never so much of a trader to begin with because, I think trading is a dangerous game in general, so I was never that much of a trader, as I said.
As a very now, bad trader, I agree with you. I agree with you very much.
I mean, especially now, you know, I think there are profits to be made by building, yes. And here's how I think about it. You know, I've invested a fair amount of money in crypto now, and it's sufficient that I don't need to be worried about. Like, it's not important to me that I retire in the next month or the next year or even necessarily in the next 2 or 5 years. You know, my time horizon is not that short. And even if it is, you know, I don't necessarily need it. I don't necessarily need to draw upon crypto for those funds. So in terms of financial incentives, it does not make sense for me to invest marginal effort into squeezing out risky gains, playing with leverage, or trying to, you know, play around with various trading schemes or so on and so forth. Like, obviously, if I see free money, I'll try to pick it up, probably. But at the margin, I think it's most effective and most profitable, as well as most rewarding and satisfying for me to focus on more orthogonal efforts, such as, you know, as mm-hmm. I mentioned, building. So, you know, currently I work at CropSwap as a protocol researcher, and so that's, you know, certainly a large part of what I would consider to be my efforts on building. Beyond that, you know, the research that I do sort of independently, the blog posts that I write, things of that nature.
So, you know, it's funny to mention like having a short time horizon, but then also being in the space for a relatively short amount of time. Can I ask, and like, this can be as general as you want, absolutely no docs required, but, you know, kind of what field were you in, or what was your focus, what was your passion before crypto?
Oh, sure. I would say it was tech adjacent. Mm-hmm. So related field, although ultimately it was quite distant from crypto. So it's really only through, you know, conversations with friends and so on that I came to learn mm-hmm. of crypto and, you know, various projects and so on that are being.
No, I think it's interesting. Crypto is one of those very few spaces where you can come in relatively new to the space and kind of like rapidly start interacting with people who are like kind of veterans who have seen the last, you know, bull market, or have seen 2017, what have you, to like make a place there. Do you feel like you had like previous experiences that kind of like set you up to be able to be in this space?
Well, I've always enjoyed learning new things. I've always been a dilettante, you know, favoring breadth over depth, maybe not necessarily out of choice, but just out of disposition. And so I think dispositionally, that does take me quite well suited. So I've always, you know it's interesting, you know, comment on what exactly allows me to rapidly ramp up my skill set, you know, from the perspective of pre-existing skills or personality characteristics. Generally, you know, I've noticed that there are some people who do not like to accept black boxes in their thinking. So, you know, these people are very smart, but they have trouble getting into new fields because they will get into certain rabbit holes and they won't actually get started necessarily in a basic way without a more foundational or fundamental understanding. And so they'll really struggle with fields that are orthogonal to their prior experiences. But for me, I've always been comfortable with accepting some degree of black boxing my thinking, which, you know, as you get more and more in depth, you uncover those black boxes and you understand the mechanisms within But at the basic level, just to do simple actions and conduct, you know, simple activities on the blockchain, you most things you can at least temporarily accept that they do what they do for reasons that you don't necessarily know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny, like crypto really is like an autodidact dream, right? Like it is a self-teaching and self-learning landscape where there's like a direct correlation between the amount of time and effort and learning that you put in your own time to your success. Not to say that there aren't people who, you know, I'm not going to say that the person who executed the $5.8 billion Sheep hold was, you know, maybe an autodidactic driven learner, but there are certainly still ways for people to, you know, kind of maximize their time that they put in. You know, do you think that is a hindrance or a help to people? Like, is it too intimidating to get in? Do you feel like for most people, like for most retail audiences?
I think it is.
Do you think that's the appeal?
No, I think, well, it depends on what you mean by get in. You know, like for development work at present, you do have to be an autodidact. Documentation is terrible. There's very little, like there's no easy, simple project in my opinion to do crypto to get started. You know, it's very monolithic and you just have to dive in and accept and sort of play around with things until you get into the sense of like how things work. Right? Like if I were saying to someone, well, like if someone asked me how to get into crypto, I wouldn't even know where to start because like if I could say, you know, oh, if you like try trading tokens or try deploying an ERC-20 or something, but ultimately all of those are so dependent on other contextual factors. It's like you just have to dive in and experience the gestalt of all the different components interacting until you have a more consolidated sense of how it fits together. But for retail, you know, for wide adoption, ultimately, I think that the end user will not even know what a specific blockchain is. They won't see the difference between blockchains. They don't. They won't have wallets that need you to switch between RPCs. All of that will be abstracted away. But I think that is a process that will take 5, if not 10 or more years of tooling and engineering before it really matures.
Well, you wrote an article last month on your Substack of 6 long-term crypto predictions, and one of those like stood out to me in what you're saying, which was your 5th one, which is Ethereum will remain more relevant than many can imagine, and you acknowledge this multi-chain future, and I think like right now a big amount of the conversation in the space is around, you know, if not just multi-chain but interoperable chain. You know, a lot of people are really in the IBC system right now. A lot of people that we know we're talking about are involved with like the layer 0 Stargate conversation. I kind of wanted to dive into that in a little more just because it's not really a controversial prediction, right? That Ethereum will remain relevant. But do you think like even as we see these layer 2 solutions scaling, even as we see, you know, alternative places pulling in a lot of liquidity or alternative blockchains, things like, you know, for corporate NFTs, things like Flow, or you know, for Asian markets, things like, you know, let's say even Tron, like what is, you know, where is your conviction in Ethereum coming from? Is it just that Vitalik is so brilliant? Is it just like that there is, you know, name value as understanding it as kind of the silver to Bitcoin's gold? Like where, you know, where do you think Ethereum really positions itself in that multi-blockchain future?
Well, ultimately, whenever you design a blockchain, you have to make certain trade-offs, right? So currently, it's posited that these alternative layer 1 solutions may be superior to Ethereum. And in some respects, they may be. But I don't, like, I think that's the thing, you know, with Vitalik and the Ethereum Foundation. You know that they're very technically adept, and you can really read all of their thinking, most of which has been conducted publicly. And so you can see that it's not as though they've ignored these solutions that other blockchains have implemented. Rather, they've considered them and they've considered the trade-offs, and they simply judge the trade-offs to not be worth it. Right. So I think from a long-term perspective, Ethereum has perhaps more... I have a lot of confidence, I suppose, that they've, even if they haven't made, you know, necessarily perfectly optimized decisions, they have thought about all the trade-offs with a very long-term view. And so I think from that perspective, it will remain more relevant than people imagine, because as we see it, with scaling, you know, these problems which you ignore first year or two or three, they eventually crop up. You know, you see Solana introducing fee markets, you see transaction congestion on Polygon. AVAX fees are actually quite high sometimes these days. Secondly, I think there's a pretty strong first or second mover advantage to chain security, and in that respect, Ethereum will likely remain quite dominant. For example, with Polygon, right? I don't actually feel comfortable putting my funds on Polygon for any extended period of time. Partially because, the network was down for like a whole day a week ago, and that's just not acceptable. Secondly, the level of security from an economic perspective is much lower. The degree of centralization is much higher. If at all possible, I keep my funds on the most secure chains possible, and by that I mean mostly Ethereum or Bitcoin. I really, really don't. It makes me honestly quite anxious to have money sitting around on places like AVAX or Polygon or even on Arbitrum, which is maybe a bit.
It's funny, I really think one of the cleanest arguments for Ethereum's use case for a general public or maybe from that security standpoint is that Ethereum eventually takes the place of large scale bank wire transfers in a traditional financial model, right? It is for moving large sums of money securely in a push transaction manner that will be used by large institutions or large traders or large financial houses, right? Like these other options kind of don't make that use case. And also you have to be moving large amounts of money occasionally to make it worth it. I wonder though, do you think that these layer two solutions and we know so many smarter people than me, certainly, who have been playing around with them, but do you think that is a layer of complexity and abstraction too far for the average person to be explaining it imagine to, I don't know, some boomer or some TradFi thing. So you have to take your this and put it here and then transfer it to this network. And it's technically on this network, but it's actually a second layer of it. Do you think that layer of complexity is just too much for people, right? Because you can just, Solana seems a lot more straightforward, certainly with their FTX integrations or Solana Pay, what have you. Do you worry that the layer twos are solving problems that make them only more appealing to real crypto natives, people like us, people who are already in deep?
I don't think so. I mean, here's an interesting perspective from someone, from the viewpoint of someone of myself, who joined crypto just quite recently. When I first bridged onto EVM chain, so I started out with Solana, and then when I first bridged on the EVM chains and started playing around on Polygon and Arbitrum and so on, I actually did not have any mental differentiation between layer twos and between side chains like Polygon, right? Like Avalanche, Arbitrum, Polygon, they all felt very similar. I wouldn't say similar, but they felt as though they were categorically part of the same type of chains, right? There was Ethereum, which was very expensive, and then there was everything else. And I did not mentally distinguish between what was an optimistic rollup or what was a sidechain and so on and so forth. And now, of course, I do mentally, but from the perspective of the end user, I think people overestimate the degree to which people are even aware experientially of these differences. Because with bridges like Synapse, you don't even have to deal with Ethereum. On and off ramp, you can actually withdraw from centralized exchanges straight to layer twos like Arbitrum even. So I think this centralized to decentralized position is quite smooth. Ultimately, I think business businesses will also crop up, which will abstract away all of this from large conglomerates. Either they will have an internal department which will figure this out, or they will contract services of some external company to set up a system, and they won't necessarily actually have to worry about or understand all the different details involved.
I mean, if you want to talk about the experience probably for a more casual user of moving between side chains or chains within the same ecosystem, right? You can look at Cosmos Hub as a design example from that. Obviously, not exactly a one-to-one, but I feel there is a lower barrier to entry for people to understand that than there is to understand right, like bridging, or which of these layer twos do I use? Because, right, the average person might know Ethereum, but they, you know, they might not necessarily know which optimistic rollup, or they don't know what zero proof knowledge is. At the same time, though, it does feel like something like Cosmos Hub is geared towards, and I mean no shade with this, like a nerdier audience, right? An audience that seems to understand it implicitly.
Yep. I think that's true. I think that's true. Cosmos has a very technical appeal, which it's not clear to me yet if that's an advantage or a disadvantage. I'm inclined to believe that it's an advantage. And I think what has ended up happening is that Cosmos has actually ended up surprisingly user-friendly because of that. Like, it's a very pleasant experience to bridge onto Osmosis and to bridge between chains. For some reason, I just have more confidence in my bridging transactions over there, even though that doesn't necessarily make sense. I mean, I suppose it's all, you know, relays through Osmosis, and so that's actually pretty... I mean, as insofar as I trust Osmosis, I suppose I trust the bridging processes there. It is certainly nerdier, and so it's unclear to what extent that might hinder overall adoption. But I do see a surprising amount of products, of new products and protocols being built on Cosmos. So I remain optimistic that it may prove to be more appealing in the future than people realize once these projects actually mature. Because it's not EVM compatible, right? So you can't just... As is often the case, people will just copy-paste the same projects from chain to chain, but sure. If you can't do that, then people are forced to some degree to have real innovations.
You keep coming back to this thing of trust and feeling comfortable, which in a macro technical sense, right, that's the whole question with cryptocurrency, right, is being trustless, is solving Byzantine general problems, is achieving consensus, right, on a very meta level, right, that's the whole conversation. But for you as an individual, and I guess this is kind of a two-pronged question, firstly, like what establishes, you know, like trust and confidence in something for you? And then my second part of the question, which, you know, we can circle back to, is like in a social dynamic, in a social setting, what is it that makes you feel comfortable and trusting of like fellow Anons, right? Like we, you know, you and I have talked before, like what is it that makes you comfortable, I guess, in those two-pronged questions, in technically and then socially?
Well, technically, I think having a strong level of economic security baked into the chain is pretty compelling. It would take a lot of money to attack it for your blockchain at the end of the day. Or if you wanted to, you know, co-opt large group of miners, you would have to potentially collude with quite a large number of separate entities, right? So the risk that people will just randomly decide to screw me over or manage somehow assaults the integrity of the chain is relatively low. And I wouldn't say zero, but it certainly makes me more comfortable. Like the barrier to attack the Ethereum chain, I think, is ultimately quite a bit higher than a barrier to attack any centralized exchange, because centralized exchanges will always be vulnerable to social engineering attacks, much like the hack of Bitfinex, I believe. I think it's been alluded that was conducted through social engineering techniques, where they obtained the private keys to some, you know, hot wallets or something. And, you know, that's just not possible with Ethereum, thankfully. Well, as far as I'm aware, I mean...
Right. We never want to speak in absolutes, right? Because then one day that clip will come back to haunt us.
Yeah. And then socially, you know, that's an interesting question as well. I mean, most people are pretty nice, and as long as I interact, like, I mean, you know, I wouldn't say I trust anyone completely, but as I talk to people more and more and get to know them, like, it's not so difficult to really get a sense of who can be trusted, I think. There's always some danger, I admit, which is why I'm not, you know, telling everyone my real name and location. But ultimately, people in general are not so psychotic that they will go after you for random things, right? Of course, I also try not to screw people over, which I think tends to help. It's good that people don't have a reason to track you down or anything. People are often quite nice and quite kind and quite helpful. And ultimately, I think you could take that to the extent that it's exhibited as a reflection of their true credibility or trustworthiness.
I'm gonna kind of poke here at that space in between those two answers, because on the one hand, the things that you called out as like your concerns in a technical environment are almost diametrically opposed to your concerns in a social environment, right? You said social engineering, people getting together to collude, a fundamentally kind of, you know, a skeptical view of, you know, if we want to take the dark forest metaphor, right, that there are entities out there that you are not aware of, so the smartest thing to do is either be silent or try and destroy them first. And then alternatively, you go, it's pretty actually easy to find out if people are good. I guess my, like, root of that question is, like, do you find yourself, like, fundamentally optimistic about people in general?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, if you look at the broad trajectory of human history, I think things have basically been on a pretty good uptrend for the last, I don't know, like 10,000 years, ever since people started discovering and performing agriculture. I think human nature has roughly improved. Like, there's obviously fundamental limits to that, in the sense that, like, genetically, you know, someone born today is not that much dissimilar to someone born 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. I mean, obviously, there's some drift. People could say various things about that, but the fundamental hardware is not different. But culturally, people are broadly improving over time, and it's obviously there's a process of experimentation, so to speak. But I would say that it's good to be optimistic. It's correct to be optimistic about human civilization broadly. That being said, I do find myself sometimes a bit depressed by the state of the world. Just, you know, people think they're very counterproductive, not just to their own, to other people's interests, but also to their own personal interests as well. So it's a bit sad, but, you know, I've sort of just accepted that as the inevitable state of the world, at least for the time being.
I think it's, you know, going back on that personal interest thing, right? Do you think it is possible? And this is a broad and very large question, but, like, do you think it is possible to kind of have that optimistic, cooperative mindset when fundamental self-interest is involved, right? Like, almost game theoretic question here. Like, we are in a fundamentally financial space. When we are working with people, we are working in a fundamentally decentralized, largely anonymous financial space. Are those two values, you know, incompatible? Is it too much to ask for the trust? Because it almost feels like, right, if you choose to default to cooperate every time, somebody is going to choose to defect and your entire matrix falls apart. You know, do you think that is like a symptom of being in a fundamentally financial space?
No, I don't agree with that, because I think I'm a big believer in capitalism and free markets broadly. I believe that people pursuing the self-interest and collective in the very broad sense. So if everyone pursues their individual self-interest, that is a much easier and much more effective way of getting to a good collective outcome in the long-term future than anything else humans have ever been able to devise, any centralized top-down solution people have ever been able to come up with. And I think especially the last 500 or so years of history have just proven that that's simply correct. You know, if you want to ask questions like how do we get to a better future, or how do you get something done in a very short or medium term sense, that is a very difficult computation for any individual entity to solve. However, if you allow everyone to pursue their own individual self-interest, then that very complex computation is effectively optimized through all these individual agents optimizing their individual functions. That allows you to solve problems on a scale that people have struggled with for millennia. Yeah,
I mean, from a theoretical, like in the, you know, nuance that is theory, I think that's correct. But I mean, then you have to contend with the real world factors, right? Like the vast majority of people do not actually even get the opportunity to act in their own fundamental self-interest because they were, you know, not born in the correct zip code, or they were not born with the adequate resources, or that they did not have the opportunity to go to the right school that sets them up. I mean, it's very hard to argue for, you know, a free market sense of egalitarian self-interest when CEOs in America make 300 times their their average worker. So like I think that that system, right, if that is something to aspire to, then that is something like wholly to do with cryptocurrency. I think it is largely divorced and separated from the actual like context of history, and like certainly the last 500 years of history have done just as much to prove that the free market is flawed and mostly due to human inputs is why it's flawed. Do you think that the nature essentially of cryptocurrency, of moving towards this free market system, you know, I've talked to a lot of people over the years in crypto, and it's a very interesting split of how many people, myself included, are anti-capitalist or who believe in a type of like collectivization or social safety net system that is antithetical to capitalism. Do you think that there is...
Because you see quite a large diversity of views in crypto from people who are communist or socialist or very heavily collectivist to people who are really quite at the extreme of the libertarian fringes and really for, you know, pure anarchy in some sense, or the removal of all centralized authority. So you see quite a large diversity of views. I guess I would comment that, I don't think crypto is necessarily dependent on a hyper-capitalist view, although from a historical perspective, it has originated from a libertarian, and in particular from a very Austrian perspective, where people are distrustful of centralized government, and people are, in particular, actually very distrustful of centralized banking, which personally I actually quite disagree with. I think modern monetary policy is pretty decent, everything, when you take everything into account.
So that's kind of where my question was leading to, is like, do you think that there is a middle ground, kind of an, or not even middle ground, a novel solution to be found in cryptocurrency that somehow takes these great parts of, let's say, free market capitalist thinking? I'm not going to necessarily say entirely libertarian thinking, because things like seatbelts are good, right? And I'm not going to say communist thinking, but I am going to say socialist thinking. Do you think there is a path of like individual interest, self-interest, that works with a communal system that takes care of its weakest members, and that does things to undo like the worst parts of either system? Can that be, you know, do you think that can be found in the crypto space?
I think so. I think that really can be found, and you see perhaps beginnings of that with charitable projects like Gitcoin and so on. I mean, maybe it's a bit of a stretch, right? But on the other hand, crypto is also a very novel industry. Like these, it's very inspiring. I mean, from the collective action of decentralized actors, that you come up with these grant projects that fund things for the public good. It's going to be difficult in crypto, particularly because there's no way of verifying identity, right? And so, if you want to talk about helping communities and so on, it's difficult to do that in a way that doesn't expose yourself to fraudulent claims. But you could see, for example, communities, small communities coming together and using crypto as a way to, you know, for example, share resources or share financial resources. Small families or communities, that might be an easy way for them to, you know, help each other out when they're in need, right? Especially if they're underbanked or if they don't have access to traditional financial systems, or perhaps if those financial systems are not amenable to them for whatever reason, whether it's lack of access or whether it's active discrimination. If a small community could somehow use crypto to pool resources together, I think that would be, for example, one way in which people can use crypto to, not just in a profiteering sense, but in a collectivist and truly a collectively beneficial way. And you sort of see that with Ukraine, right? People have raised a huge amount of money for Ukraine in a way that simply would not be possible, I think, for crypto. That level of immediate global donation, like, which would always... factor, and you have to deal with all these issues like, oh, well, how does like some random person in, like, Tunisia or whatever like donate to this other entity that's like, you know, based in Belgium or whatever, and it gets really complicated, right? Like crypto is a very like, all of that doesn't matter with crypto. It allows global financial coordination in a way which is novel and unprecedented. And that applies just as much to global communities, I think, as it does to smaller local communities, which, as I mentioned, they don't have access to legacy systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, and that is one of those things, like the underbanked thing is something unbanked or underbanked is something I take very, very seriously because I've seen it a lot in my life. Certainly places I've lived are kind of places where the American financial system has failed and failed dramatically for the people who live there. And they are now in kind of a situation where they have been left behind by the capitalist market. At the same time, though, you know, I think it is interesting. Crypto is one of those places that can kind of double a meaning that you know, often parroted from each according to their ability to each according to their need, which has always struck me as something that is both capitalist and both socialist, right? It is both saying you are entitled to the work that you do by your own ability, and it is also saying that your ability dictates how your needs are met. And I think crypto really lands there, to circle back to like when we were talking about autodidactic learning, like it is kind of your input determines your output. And at the same time, like, you know, crypto can exist in such a space that there are people who, while they might not necessarily, you know, be the CEO, be whatever, be in that position of power, they are nonetheless entitled to some benefits. And I think that's like the core of it that's interesting to me is that crypto naturally, despite being anonymous, despite being decentralized, naturally ends up collectivizing in some way. People want to pool assets and resources. People want to get yield together. People want to trade alpha. And I think it's, you know, I think it's making these models of like global communities that are, like you said, it doesn't matter if you're Tunisia, you know, wherever you are in a global, entirely digital setting, collectivization. And that's like the most compelling part of it to me is like a real, you know, nation without borders type situation. Do you think we're kind of rushing towards that? Do you think we'll see kind of the rise of like this, I don't want to say digital nation state, because that sounds really big, but of this identity that is more important than national identity?
It's unclear. I mean, I think that's a good question. And to some extent, it's, you know, with crypto, identity is an interesting thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting that even though everyone comes together from different parts of the world, there is sort of, in some vague sense, a collective sense of identity among people who use crypto. You know, it's representing some vague sort of values. But I think as crypto popularizes, that will inevitably dissolve. Hey, I think that will not last. Or maybe it will last in very small corners of the internet, but I think it's inevitable that as crypto is adopted by the masses, that the meaning and ideologies of people who came before will have less and less of an impact on what is considered to be, you know, the nature of crypto. And in the end, it will become sort of like, I mean, it's like with the internet, right? I'm sure people who created the internet had various ideologies. And back in the day, when everyone was chatting on Usenet, there was a very particular culture, right? Of course, many different ideologies and perspectives were represented, but there was certainly a sort of internet user culture among Usenet posters and IRC channels and forum posters. And that's sort of what we see with crypto Twitter nowadays, right? But over time, I expect that will largely become diluted, sadly. But that is the price of adoption, perhaps.
Yeah, and you know, I would say very like romantic sci-fi notions of being a member of like a geographically unbound nation, you know, and I think that is like some people take that extremely seriously. There are a lot of people that we know that have written about that in very serious terms. And I do think you're right, like it will be diluted by entry, and I think it will be actively countermanded by a lot of government systems and a lot of establishment systems who see that as, you know, obviously a threat to like global hegemonic powers. Because, you know, when people start collecting together and joining together, it ends up creating quite seismic change that I think is pretty dangerous, pretty lethal to previous systems that we've operated under. I wanted to change gears just for a moment and circle back on something you said. You said that you didn't have a lot of confidence in GameFi. So I just, the episode before this one, I talked with Monolith, who's really into GameFi quite a bit. And I mentioned that in my day job, I actually end up working with GameFi startups quite a bit. I wonder if you could just kind of delineate, because I certainly know my reasons why I'm skeptical, and I'm sure everyone has them, but why did you choose to shout out GameFi as something that you're particularly unconvinced of?
Well, it's very simple. People play games for fun, and so if the games are not fun, then no one will play them, and the product will fail. At the end of the day, I don't play games so I can grind out a minimum wage. Not even the minimum wage in my country, but I don't play games so I can grind out like a third world minimum wage. I work for that, and I play games for fun. And so these games like Act or even like DeFi Kings, I think they're basically more or less just garbage. I mean, they're just wealth transfers, right, from later participants to early participants. Which is fine. I mean, if I get into them early, I don't mind it. It will transfer wealth to me, but I have no particular illusions that these are interesting. These are just not interesting models to me. They're not. I've seen no real innovation in this space. I would like to. I think perhaps it will come in time when people know how to integrate crypto economic systems and non-fungible tokens into not just individual games, but ecosystems of games or cross-game systems of a sort. But that will take a long time. Developing games is hard work and slow work.
Well, I was going to mention that. I mean, that one of my initial points of skepticism with GameFi was, and again, no hate, but like Star Atlas. Like, I'm looking at that as somebody who loves to play video games, as somebody who works with traditional companies before in the gaming space. Like, you know, looking at this and seeing people buying assets for something that I just cannot fathom actually being released in the state that it is promised. And I do think a lot of these games are, you know, they are, like you said, they're just wealth transfers at maybe some end goal. They're a way of like barely eking out some subsistence living in some part of the world where you can be incentivized for it. But yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's like none of these look fun. None of these seem feasible from a technical standpoint. If you want to be like, you know, correlate it to something like Star Atlas to EVE Online, like it's just the gap there seems so massive in what it seems like they could actually produce. And it doesn't seem long term, right? It doesn't seem to have a lot of longevity. A lot of people in the space are like, you know, liquidity mercenaries who go in, get incentives, get raid liquidity pools, get them while the API is good, and then leave. And there's really not a lot of evidence that a lot of these crypto native games won't just be that.
Yep, I agree. I mean, they will simply disappear with time. Or who knows? I mean, there's this one game, right? This sci-fi game which has never come out, like Star Citizen or whatever. And there's still a community there who believes that when they Star Citizen come out, and they've spent thousands, if not millions, of dollars funding this game. I mean, what, like Star Citizen, how much has it raised? Like hundreds of millions of dollars? And yet, everyone knows that it will never come out. And yet, there is still a community of people who believes it will eventually happen and keep throwing money at it. So perhaps these vaporware scams will last longer than we expect. So I'm not in any hurry to be clear, but we'll see.
I mean, that's a bag holder mentality, right? It's like somebody feels attached for whatever reason, for financial reasons or parasocial reasons, to a project, and they will hold on as long as it takes just to feel like they are vindicated. And you know, that's not unique to GameFi by any terms, but I do think that GameFi amplifies it because people like to play video games and they like to have some fantasy world that they live in where this game can be my full-time job. I'm not good enough to stream on Twitch, but I can farm, you know, whatever in-game currency here and either make a living or make a massive profit or whatever. And yeah, I agree. I don't think the tech's there. I don't think the vision is quite there yet. And again, like, I'd love to be proven wrong. I mean, if I could just play Elden Ring and get like $500 a day, fucking sign me up, right? That's the dream. But yeah, I think it is one of those parts of our system that maybe people aren't even aware of how immature it is yet.
Yep. In general, people are not aware of what it takes to build something. That's something I've noticed. I mean, maybe that's not surprising, right? Most people in general do not build or create and have very little real awareness of what real projects entail. So they don't really understand what it takes to make something new. And I think that's
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's it comes with the territory, right? If you, that's the nature of allowing people to invest in these speculative projects and to buy their, you know, valueless governance tokens. People will have expectations which are vastly, vastly unrealistic and simply make no sense. Which is a bit sad. I mean, I think that's something I've, broadly speaking, I'm skeptical. Like, there's this notion in crypto that allowing people to come together in a decentralized fashion and help make decisions will somehow lead to better outcomes. And I actually find that questionable. I think that's basically wrong. You know, I support the idea.
You actually wrote about that. I was rereading your article ahead of that. You wrote an article called An Anti-Populist Vision of DAOs. Where you kind of touch on that, where you talk about, like, large-scale voting just doesn't work. Do you think
I wouldn't say
like
doesn't, not in a broad sense, but certainly in crypto.
Yeah, I mean, and in this space, do you think that is, like, that style of consensus building is just not? And we agreed on this, so, because I think we wrote similar articles around this time, and you and I kind of arrived at a similar point, which is that existing, like, corporate structure is actually already optimized in a lot of ways. The parts of it that aren't optimized is something like, you know, a CEO or, you know, the large, you know, swaths underneath it, but that the actual, like, idea of corporate structure works.
Yeah.
Do you think we need to shed a little bit of this, like, idealistic, everyone gets to vote, true decentralization in order to advance?
We do. I think it's very immature. I mean, I think it will eventually, it will get there naturally just through the fact that projects that do this will not succeed, or at least to a lesser extent, right? The more effectively managed projects will simply grow faster and win out. So there's a natural pruning effect here. I don't think any active effort needs to be taken to disabuse people of this notion. But I think it would be good if people disabused themselves of this notion faster rather than slower. Because again, it's tremendously naive to think that you can just take random people off the street and have to give some sort of useful opinion, informed opinion on how to run some complex DeFi protocol.
Right. Or that even that such a structure, even if they were informed, that such a amorphous structure would even succeed.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, you ultimately need some level of top-down decision-making to get things done efficiently. People may not like that, but that's simply the state of the world.
I mean, but I think it's, you know, I think it's a thesis, it's one that you and I share that is, you know, pretty well backed up. We can see a lot of projects that have failed for that reason. We can see a lot of communities that have come apart for exactly that reason. You put it in a really good way. I believe that DAOs are formed by people in their early 20s with little to no experience working traditional jobs and therefore have zero experience with typical corporate structures or the challenges of scaling a growing organization. Something that I agree with 100%. Not that, you know, I had management jobs in my early 20s. And whatever experience I had, at least I had some facility with it. But I do think if you add that into how amorphous and poorly defined our space is in terms of governance and structure, I think you're like right on the money. And and something that I've talked about before is like this main character syndrome that everyone has where they go, well, X protocol might have failed for whatever reasons. My protocol won't fail for that. And I think that's dangerous. I think it is a dangerous line of thinking that ends up watching projects just like totally implode.
I agree. I mean, people don't learn from the mistakes of the past as much as they should, right? Particularly in a space like crypto, where, I mean, the incentive structure naturally works against it because people don't even need long-term or medium-term success to get rich. They just launch a project, dump the token, and then now they're retired because they have like a couple million. And ultimately, they don't actually, many projects, I would not say all, but many projects do not really need to think about whether they'll be around in a year or 2 years or 3 years, which it's hard to know exactly. Like, to lock someone into some vesting structure for a number of, for, you know, 5-4 years is not necessarily optimal either. But on the other hand, the massive retail liquidity, I mean, people are basically giving protocols massive amounts of free money, and so it's hard to say, well, like, don't take it, like, don't get rich. I mean, obviously, you know, if it's free money, it's hard to it's hard to say that people are wrong for taking it. Certainly,
right,
I would.
Of course. But, and certainly when their internal financial structure is under no level of scrutiny or responsibility that traditional corporations have. Like, people on in DAOs don't have the same level of transparency or not even transparency, the level of accountability and legal framework that traditional companies have to shareholders and stakeholders, which is ironic because you can see everything happening on chain, right? As long as it's happening on chain, you can see it, but there's vastly less disclosure in our space, voluntary disclosure. There's vastly less, you know, anything like auditing that happens for a lot of these projects. So it is almost, you know, like a question of like, yeah, you're right. Like, who am I to, who's to blame me for getting rich? There are no protections, you know, for me taking this money. I'm under no obligations. I don't even have an identity that is tied to my real one. So yeah, I think it is a dangerous thing to set up an organization that is completely flat. And even more so when whatever your voting is done by numerical amounts of tokens rather than just like a one of one voting or something. The minute you make your voting token into an asset that has value, I think that's where it like totally falls apart.
Yep. I mean, it's difficult. Like, yeah, I mean, people have tried different things and maybe there's some value, like disaggregating like, the financial value from the governance value. We'll see. I have fairly high confidence that we'll converge onto an effective model in the future. But what exactly that model will entail, I think, remains a bit opaque.
Yeah, well, it would be nice. At least you and I will be burned at the stake together when we're revealed as, you know, like centralized corporate shills.
Perhaps. That's great.
Are you ready for kind of our ending fun lightning round questions?
Absolutely.
Perfect. The first one, so I, you know, I ask this to people and usually there's a little bit more ambiguity to it, but in your case, I don't really know. Where did your name come from?
That's a good question. Well, I, you know, there's this joke that was going around on Twitter, which is that all of you like Xerox fanboy accounts are just federal agents, and that's what inspired the name.
Yeah, and just leaning into that. I mean, that's why I said there's a lot less ambiguity. It's like, I'm pretty sure I could figure out the joke. I'm pretty sure everyone else did as well. But I was, yeah, you know, you never know. Your answer could have been something like, it's actually funny. Like, I used to be a Fed and my call sign was Femboy. You know, but it's glad to know that there's nothing like that. Who is your favorite poster on crypto Twitter? Who's the person that makes you, like, light up? You get the notification. You're like, this person is solid gold.
That's a good question. I have a lot of people I like, but it's hard to just pick one. There's
you can pick as many as you want. Shill the crew.
Let me look at my follower list. I have a very bad memory, so I have to I like Lawrence's posts a lot. I think they're quite funny, especially lately.
Lawrence is underrated for his boomer humor.
Agree. Like, and I like some of the small accounts, small bear, and so on. The recent proliferation is a bit much, but you know, I think overall
something that crypto Twitter doesn't really know how to do because everyone's such like a terminally online parasocial. Like autist is like knowing when that a joke has run its course.
Yeah, it keep going.
Just like, rolling. It will still be funny.
I really enjoy Jusu's post. People don't like them because people say that he makes bull posts and dumps on everyone. But I don't really care about short-term prices, so he can dump as much as he likes. And I just find his posts
also
fun.
It's his prerogative, right? It's his purpose. And I wrote about this. It's like, These public figures are all working for the betterment of their own community or own company. It's like the idea that someone is like a knight in shining armor for us is hysterical. Yeah, so I always found it very funny when people would be like, can you believe what this guy did? And I would be like, yes, I absolutely, like, who gives a shit? No, like,
yeah, and I believe that ultimately he is optimistic about the future of crypto. So from that perspective, I think his posting is quite justified.
People forget this is also a game of money and a game of profit. So yeah, he's incentivized to be optimistic. And yeah, people getting upset about it really blows my mind. We mentioned like these well-known people. Who do you think is like underrated? Who would you want to like see blow up overnight? You know, who do you think
That's a good question. Oh, it's spinning, dangerous question because if they blow up, then maybe they'll make a new alt. That's a tough question. I find I don't know how to say his username, but his display name is L, and I find his post about AMMs quite good.
Absolutely, in general, absolute I find killer his
quality. I think
absolute savage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that's a phenomenal answer.
Yeah, I like their posts a lot. I've learned a lot from them.
This one is, and if there's no answer to this one, I can go ahead and just cut it. But do you have a favorite cocktail, favorite thing to drink, favorite beer, favorite wine?
Oh, well, I've enjoyed some chestnut beers. I've enjoyed some peanut butter stouts as well. I don't drink that much, but I generally just try to experience new cocktails or new drinks with novel flavor combinations. I've had a hot chocolate cocktail that I thought was really nice, and I had something like a hot chocolate cinnamon cocktail in New York winter, which I thought that was really, really, really comfy. Ultimately, I'm not too picky. As long as something is, like, I enjoy a very wide range of flavors, and in general, my culinary horizons are quite broad, as long as something is high quality, I will probably like it. You know, I can stand bitterness. I don't mind sweetness. That's not expensive. So on and so forth.
Speaking of high quality, if you had, and it doesn't have to be of all time, but what's one of your favorite anime of all time?
That's a good question. What would be my favorite anime? I guess Penguin Drum is one favorite anime. I think that was really, it was very moving. It was very well directed. From an artistic perspective, from a musical perspective, from a plot perspective, Penguin Drum is probably one of the best anime I've seen. I've also liked, there was this soft tennis anime. I forgot what it was called, but it was about, you know, high school boys playing soft tennis. Yeah, the name doesn't come to me at the moment, but I thought that was also really, maybe you can look up the name later or something.
It's funny, sports anime is a fun and funny choice, and it's one I feel called on to like defend a lot. My wife makes fun of me because she'll see me like crying to like Haikyuu or whatever, or like Yuri on Ice, and I'm like, it's not about the sports, it's about the emotions of these young men.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, yeah, it's... I mean, I like the sports as well, but the depth of emotion, I know, I find myself riding waves of emotion, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then just to conclude, is there anything that you want to like plug, anything that you want to shill, anything that you're working on that you're really excited to talk about, any shout outs you want to give?
As you know, I've been working at CrossFop for a while, and I think it's a really nice, I think it's been a really nice place to be. I'm very excited about where the protocol goes. So that being said, I imagine most of the listeners here will already have been aware of CrossFop to begin with. I've seen it come up in conversation a number of times. We are hoping to publish several blog posts soon. So doing with some, you know, open-ended research into Uniswap that we've done, that I've sort of taken the lead on. And so I would advise my listeners to keep an eye out for those posts when they come. Should not be much longer before you see the first of them.
Well, cool. Yeah, so that was it for all my questions. I just want to say thank you for coming on. Thank you for having like a really intense high-level conversation with me. You know, it's not every day that you get to talk in such like broad and big terms about so many important things. So yeah, I just want to say I really appreciate you coming on. And if you ever want to hang out again, you got some new ideas to share, I would love to have you back.
Sure, absolutely. I think that sounds fun. Maybe you can revisit in a couple months or something. This was great, very enjoyable, and thank you for the opportunity.
Of course. Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you for, you know, being willing to come on the podcast and let me ask you like amorphous questions. This one will be going up while I will be on vacation. And then we'll be back next week with even more. If you are so inclined, please subscribe, leave us a rating, and we will see you next time. Thank you.